I'm John Strum, and this is Real Talk MS. It's August 16th, and we have a lot to talk about. More than half the people living with MS report significant disruptions in their sleep and difficulty maintaining a consistent sleep schedule. That can lead to additional health issues, along with an overall decline in quality of life and well-being. Joining me today is Dr. Katie Siang-Sukun, a physical therapist, associate professor, and the director of the Sleep Health and Wellness Lab at the University of Kansas Medical Center Department of Physical Therapy and Rehabilitation Science. And we're talking about how sleep affects MS, the importance of sleep to your overall health, and what you can do if you're experiencing sleep problems. But before we get to my conversation with Dr. Siang-Sukun, there are a few other things that you should know about. Last week, Congress passed the Inflation Reduction Act, and while this piece of legislation covers a lot of ground, including deficit reduction and climate change, it's also the largest and most consequential health care bill since the Affordable Care Act. It's a significant win for all Americans, and especially anyone living with a chronic illness like multiple sclerosis. Passing the bill means that for the first time in history, Medicare will be allowed to negotiate drug prices with pharmaceutical companies. About 49 million Americans rely on Medicare for their prescription drug coverage, so we can look forward to Medicare having considerable leverage in those future price negotiations. The bill also caps Medicare out-of-pocket costs at $2,000 a year, beginning in 2025. And when you consider the cost of MS disease-modifying medications, this provision alone can save a family thousands of dollars a year, while helping to ensure that more people living with MS can afford to stay on their treatment plan without having to choose between paying for their prescription or buying food or paying their mortgage. This bill also keeps the additional federal subsidies in place for individuals and families purchasing their health insurance through healthcare.gov or their state's Affordable Care Act marketplace. These temporary subsidies helped make health insurance more affordable in 2020 and 2021 for millions of Americans. They were originally passed as part of the American Rescue Plan Act and were set to expire this year. Had they expired, millions of Americans earning $50,000 a year would no longer be eligible for any subsidies, while millions more would see those subsidies shrink. Insurance companies are in the process of setting their premium rates for 2023 right now, and without this legislation passing when it did, we would have seen those health insurance premiums skyrocket. This is a huge win for everyone. And the bow on this package of historic legislation is that it delivers all of these healthcare benefits without raising taxes on small businesses or on families earning $400,000 a year or less. MS activists played a major role in seeing this legislation become law. From that day back in March when the Vice President of Advocacy for the National MS Society, Stephanie Stern, testified before the Senate Finance Committee and shared her own family's struggles to afford disease-modifying medication for Stephanie's mom, who's living with MS, all the way to those thousands of emails and texts that MS activists across the country sent to their senators and representatives in Congress. This was a team effort that led to a big win. If you'd like to be part of this effort to create change and improve the lives of people affected by MS, I'll invite you to visit www.nationalmssociety.org/advocacy and join the MS Society's advocacy efforts. I think you'll discover, as I did, that advocating on behalf of your own interests is one of the most empowering things that you can do. So I hope you'll join the movement and choose to become an MS activist. You'll find that link in today's show notes. While we're talking about the cost of prescription drugs, I want to give you an update on Mark Cuban's Cost Plus Drug Company. We first talked about this game-changing venture this past March in episode 237 of Real Talk MS. As a quick refresher, the Cost Plus Drug Company is an online pharmacy that sells generic drugs. And the company's transparent pricing policy is what makes the Cost Plus Drug Company such a significant game changer. They start with the actual cost of manufacturing a generic drug, add a 15% markup plus any small fees that their manufacturing partners charge them for preparing the prescription for you, and that's it. When I first shared the news about the Cost Plus Drug Company, they weren't offering any generics for MS disease-modifying therapies, but that's changed with the recent addition of dimethyl fumarate, the generic for Tecfidera. If your prescription calls for the 240-milligram capsule of Tecfidera, for example, 60 capsules of dimethyl fumarate will cost you $54.75. You can compare that with the $6,616.87 price that other retail pharmacies actually charge for this medication. And if you happen to take baclofen to manage MS-related spasticity, you'll pay $4.20 for 30 10-milligram tablets, and you'll pay $4.50 for 30 20-milligram tablets. Now, you can compare that $4.20 price to the regular $19.80 retail price that's typically charged for baclofen's generic equivalent. As they do for all the prescription drugs they carry, the Cost Plus Drug Company shares that it costs them 90 cents to manufacture 30 10-milligram baclofen tablets. They also show that their 15% markup comes out to 30 cents. And then there's a $3 fee that they're charged for pharmacy labor, which they also disclose. I'd like to be fair and compare the way the Cost Plus Drug Company prices their prescription drugs to the way that prescription drugs are priced by insurance companies and retail pharmacies, but I can't, because that process is in no way transparent, and the players involved in the process, well, they aren't even transparent. Pharmacy benefit managers are companies that we rarely hear about, but these are the companies that negotiate and manage prescription drug prices on behalf of health insurance companies, Medicare Part D drug plans, large employers who self-insure, and others. These are the companies that create the formularies of medications that are covered by your health insurance. And these pharmacy benefit managers negotiate huge rebates and discounts from drug manufacturers that you may or may not see. We really don't know because they operate in the shadows. Now, of course, the claim is that pharmacy benefit managers' ability to negotiate large rebates from drug manufacturers leads to lower drug prices. But that may or may not be true. We don't really know what happens to those rebates and discounts and who benefits as a result. And until we see the prescription drug pricing process in the clear light of day, we can't simply point a finger at drug manufacturers as the culprits that continually raise the price of prescription drugs to the obscene levels they reach today. I'm not absolving anyone here, but until we get real transparency on how drugs are priced, how can we truly expect to have any sort of real and lasting impact on those prices? I hope you pay an online visit to the Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drug Company. You'll find baclofen, you'll find generics for several of the leading antidepressants, and perhaps other symptom management prescription medications that you're currently taking, and you'll find the generic for Tecfidera available as well. You'll also have an opportunity to request that they add drugs that they aren't yet carrying. Mark Cuban calls this company an example of humane capitalism. I call it a step in the right direction. You'll find a link to the Mark Cuban Cost Plus Drug Company in today's show notes. And speaking of show notes, if you're a regular listener, you know that when we talk about the outcome of a clinical trial, or almost anything else for that matter, I always provide a link to the details in each episode's show notes. One of the challenges of finding information online is there's an awful lot of opinion masquerading as fact, and I don't ever want anyone to think that I'm spreading information that isn't supported by evidence, by real data. That's one of the main reasons that I produce show notes for every episode of Real Talk MS. In addition to providing links to additional information, the show notes also give you a summary of each episode of the podcast, along with timestamps for every segment of that particular episode. So if you want to share or listen to a particular news story or interview again, you'll know exactly where to find it. Now here's the thing. Not every podcast has show notes, and most podcast apps don't include the show notes that accompany the podcast even when they do exist. Sometimes an app will include show notes, but won't make the links in the show notes clickable. So please keep in mind that you can always find complete show notes for every episode of Real Talk MS at our website at realtalkms.com. The show notes for the current week's episode are always right on the homepage. All you have to do is scroll down past the description of what Real Talk MS is all about, and you'll see the show notes for the current week's episode. And if you click on Past Episodes in the menu at the top of the page, you can click on any episode and not only listen to it again, but you'll also see the accompanying show notes for that episode. I hope that helps those of you who are still wondering where those show notes that I always refer to are. If you still have questions or feedback about the show notes or any other aspect of Real Talk MS, please shoot me an email, a DM, or you can even leave voicemail on our listener hotline at area code 310-526-2283 in the United States. Of course, you'll find that phone number in today's show notes. You've often heard me cite evidence that shows starting a disease-modifying medication early and staying on a treatment plan slows MS progression and so extends a better quality of life. Here's one more piece of supporting evidence for you to consider. A research team in Italy analyzed data in the Italian Multiple Sclerosis Registry from 409 people with primary progressive MS. The mean age in this group was 43, and 55% of these patients were women. Out of the 409 patients, 288 had been treated with disease-modifying medication, and 121 had not. The researchers looked at EDSS scores over a period of just over 10 years, and the team found that the people who were treated with a disease-modifying therapy, virtually any disease-modifying therapy, had a significantly reduced risk of reaching an EDSS score of 7.0, and that score indicates wheelchair dependence. Keep in mind, everyone in this study was living with primary progressive MS. So we can add one more study to so many others that demonstrate that for people living with MS, and that includes progressive MS, disease-modifying medication can make a meaningful difference in preserving your best possible quality of life. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. MS impacts women almost three times more than it impacts men. We know this to be true, but researchers are still trying to understand why it's true. And two scientists at the Icahn School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, New York, have made a discovery that may help further that understanding. The researchers analyzed genes found on the X chromosome. You might recall your high school biology class, where you learned that the X chromosome is one of two sex-determining chromosomes. Females have two X chromosomes, and males have one X chromosome and one Y chromosome. The study reviewed genetic data from 223,453 males and 264,772 females. This data was collected in the UK Biobank. Of the 488,000 plus people, 1,974 had been diagnosed with MS. And among these 1,974 people with MS, 71.9% were encoded as women. Now, the scientists analyzed 18,857 changes in a single nucleotide or a single letter of genetic code. They found 20 of these single nucleotides in 14 genes on the X chromosome to be more common among people with MS. They further found that 6 of these single nucleotides in 5 genes were associated with the maintenance and repair of the myelin sheath. And as a quick refresher, damage to the myelin sheath leads to symptoms and disability in MS. 12 single nucleotides in 7 genes were also identified as having a role in inflammation and immune function. And as one more quick refresher, in MS, inflammation due to an overactive immune system is what damages the myelin sheath. The scientists were able to conclude that these mutations in genes associated with myelination and the immune system on the X chromosome are an important component in someone who develops MS. The researchers performed a further analysis to identify individuals in this group who had both of these MS-associated genetic mutations, the genes associated with myelination and the genes associated with the immune system. This type of analysis is called a co-occurrence analysis. And this co-occurrence analysis revealed that women who had both types of gene mutations on the X chromosome were at more than a 20-time higher risk of developing MS. One day in the not-too-distant future, insights like these will help physicians start someone on a high-efficacy disease-modifying medication before that person ever develops a single MS symptom. And that proactive treatment could very well prevent that person from ever experiencing any MS symptoms. Technically, that's not a cure, but it will sure feel like one. If you'd like to review the details of this study, you'll find a link in today's show notes. I want to give you one last reminder that the 14th annual Burgers to Beat MS Day is taking place Thursday, August 18th, at A&W locations across Canada. For those of you living in Canada, or those of you with plans to be in Canada on Thursday, A&W is going to donate $2 for every teen burger sold to support the work of the MS Society of Canada. Over the past 13 years, A&W has raised over $17 million to support research, programs, and services for Canadians living with MS. Olympic gold medalist and Canadian national women's soccer team captain Christine Sinclair is once again championing this effort to honor her mother, who lived with MS. And if you'd like to participate, but you don't want to wait until Thursday, or you don't happen to live in Canada, you can visit burgerstobeatms.ca and make your online donation today. You'll find that link in today's show notes. We can't be certain about how many people affected by MS are burger fans, but research does tell us that more than half the people living with MS experience sleep disturbances. Getting quality sleep is important to maintaining overall health and wellness, and lack of restful sleep can cause daytime drowsiness and make some MS symptoms worse. In a moment, we'll meet my guest, the director of the Sleep, Health, and Wellness Lab at the University of Kansas Medical Center Department of Physical Therapy and Rehabilitation Science, Dr. Katie Siangsakon. And we're talking about how sleep impacts MS and what you can do to get a good night's sleep. I think we can all appreciate that getting a good night's sleep is something that benefits everyone. And if you're someone who's living with MS, it's perhaps even more important.
But research suggests that more than half the people living with MS report significant disruptions in their sleep and difficulty maintaining a consistent sleep schedule. Back again to tackle the topic of how sleep affects MS is Dr. Katie Siang-Sagan, an associate professor at the University of Kansas Medical Center, where she's also the director of the Sleep Health and Wellness Lab. Welcome back to the podcast, Dr. Siang-Sagan.
Thank you so much for having me again.
Quality sleep is important to maintaining overall health and wellness, but sometimes it's just hard to get a good night's sleep. And that lack of restful sleep can not only cause daytime drowsiness, it can make some MS symptoms feel worse. So maybe a good place for us to start is with a definition. How do you define quality sleep, and why is getting quality sleep particularly important for people who are living with MS?
Sleep quality can be defined in a few different ways. And if you asked five different people, you'd probably get five different definitions. But sleep quality generally just refers to how would you define your sleep? How would you describe your sleep quality? And so that's the one way that we assess it is we just ask, how would you describe your sleep quality? And I find that the words people use to describe their sleep is oftentimes very eye-opening and very telling. But we also have questionnaires that we can look at sleep quality. That way we're looking at the person's perception of their sleep and how do they describe their sleep? And the most common sleep questionnaire that we use is called the Pittsburgh Sleep Quality Index. And it includes multiple different questions about, how much sleep are you getting? How would you describe your sleep? How are different issues disrupting your sleep, like, pain or having to get up to the bathroom? Are you taking sleep medication? All of that goes into what would be considered a sleep quality number. And then there's also, instruments that we can use to measure sleep quality. And usually the most well-used definition of sleep quality is sleep efficiency, if we're using an instrument. And that is, how much sleep are you actually getting divided by the amount of time you're spending in bed. And so again, there's a lot of different sleep quality definitions. But really, probably the most important one and the one that I would use the most often is that person's description of how would they describe their sleep.
Do people who are living with MS experience more sleep problems than the general population?
They do in general. There's definitely a high prevalence of sleep issues in the general population, but it seems to be more so in people with MS. And so there's some evidence that suggests that up to 70% of people with MS have a sleep issue or a sleep disturbance. And that could be due to the MS itself. So if there's an MS lesion or lesions that are impacting the sleep centers or the wake centers in your brain, that can certainly disrupt your sleep. But then of course, there's also the common symptoms of people with MS, if it's spasticity or pain, or just the stress of having a chronic condition, those things can certainly be disruptive to sleep as well. And we certainly know that, sleep disturbances can negatively impact those MS symptoms. So we know that having a sleep disturbance or having a sleep issue can increase your perception of your pain, can increase depression, anxiety, can certainly contribute to stress if you're not able to sleep well. And so, not only do people with MS have a higher prevalence of sleep issues, but then it can certainly have a negative impact on their MS symptoms as well.
Beyond daytime drowsiness, are there any long-term consequences from lack of sleep?
So there's certainly evidence that if you're not getting sufficient quality sleep over a long term, that you are at an increased risk of developing several health consequences. So things like diabetes, obesity, depression, anxiety, even Alzheimer's disease. There's some emerging evidence that if you're not sleeping well, cancer is another potential risk. But I always want to, the caveat, though, is there's no guarantee, right? If you're not sleeping well, that doesn't mean that you're going to develop one of these chronic conditions. And so I just want to set that, kind of caveat, because I oftentimes have clients that are like, oh my gosh, I'm not sleeping well, I'm going to get X, Y, or Z. And it's like, well, that's not a guarantee. Certainly it increases your risk. And let's mitigate that risk as best we can. But there's certainly no guarantee either.
Fatigue is one of the most common symptoms of MS. It affects about 80% of the people who are diagnosed with MS. I'm wondering, does poor sleep contribute to MS fatigue?
It does. And there's definitely lots of research that shows that they are highly associated. So that if you're not sleeping well, you're at an increased risk of having fatigue. Now, the important thing is that they are different constructs or different symptoms or different issues. So while they are associated, they're not the same thing. And so I think one of the big issues is that there's not always agreement on how we define or measure fatigue. So that's part of the difficulty. And we've already talked about, you know, how we define sleep quality also depends on the researcher and how they're defining it. But certainly, you know, some of the research that shows that if you help people sleep better who have MS, that it also has an impact on their fatigue, making their fatigue improved as well. But again, like even if you are sleeping well, it's not going to completely mitigate your fatigue necessarily, because fatigue also has its own mechanisms that it's causing the fatigue as well.
Well, how can someone determine whether their fatigue is related to their MS or the result of poor sleep?
That's a great question. And it's probably going to take a little bit of trial and error. You know, I would certainly say if you are having a sleep issue and you're also having fatigue, because again, they oftentimes go together and go hand in hand. Certainly, you know, do what you can to address your sleep issue with the help of a healthcare provider, if that's indicated, and see if that has an impact on your fatigue. For a lot of people, it will, you know, but if it may be that you also need to do interventions that are addressing both the sleep issue and the fatigue issue, because although they might be similar, there certainly are interventions that are going to more directly impact the sleep and more directly impact the fatigue.
You know, research has shown that there is an association between sleep disturbances and cognitive function. So I think I have a three-part question that's very interrelated. I'm wondering what that means for people who may be over 55 or 60, what it means for people who are living with MS, and finally, what it means for people who are over 55 or 60 who are also living with MS.
Absolutely. You're absolutely right that the research shows that poor sleep is also associated with poor cognitive function. And evidence shows that, again, if you can help people sleep better, that it actually can improve cognitive function in all of those categories that you mentioned, in older adults, in people with MS, and in older adults who also have MS. I think the important thing to think about, or to at least discuss, is that, you know, cognitive function is a big umbrella term. And so, you know, there's lots of different domains of cognition. So like working memory, short-term memory, long-term memory, attention, executive function, which is that ability to make decisions. You know, so sleep can have a different impact on each of those domains of cognition. So that's where, you know, there sometimes is a little bit of discrepancy in the research, depending on which specific domain that you're looking at. But again, you know, in general, if you are not having good sleep, good quality of sleep, and addressing that sleep issue, for a lot of people, they then see a positive impact on their cognitive function if they are having better quality sleep.
If someone finds that they are experiencing sleep difficulties, are there any self-assessments that they can use to evaluate sleep, or do they need to just see a healthcare professional?
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely kind of the standard questionnaires that we use that you can do with a quick Google search. And so, you know, measuring your sleep quality, looking at excessive daytime sleepiness, looking at your risk of sleep apnea, you know, those are probably common questionnaires that people could use. And if you score above, you know, the kind of the threshold, the cutoff that the questionnaire gives you, then absolutely you want to take that information to your healthcare provider. I always appreciate it when people bring that information with them. So, you know, it helps to inform and provide me with that information. I also encourage people to keep a sleep log, you know, for a week or two. So that way they're tracking, you know, what time they're going to bed, what time they're waking up, what kind of sleep difficulties they're having. Because again, that is super eye-opening to me. It can really help me then determine, you know, what type of sleep issue they're having, but then also maybe what the best intervention might be for them. And then also tailoring the intervention for that individual can be very helpful with sleep logs. And then wearables, you know, wearables are so common nowadays. A lot of people have them. A lot of people, you know, bring that information again into me or their other healthcare provider. You know, my little bit of caution with wearables is that some are more accurate than others. So certainly, you know, don't necessarily put a whole lot of weight into the data that you're getting from your wearable. But certainly we like to look at trends. And if you aren't getting sufficient sleep, again, that's great information, not only for you, but then also can be very helpful information for your healthcare provider. So absolutely, you know, look at those sleep assessments and then bring that information to your healthcare provider if it does appear that you're having sleep issues.
I know you've conducted research looking at using cognitive behavioral therapy to treat insomnia. Can you tell us what cognitive behavioral therapy is and what you've learned through your research?
Sure. So cognitive behavioral therapy for insomnia, or CBTI for short, it is a well-used, well-studied behavioral intervention to treat insomnia. And it's actually the recommended treatment for insomnia. And generally, the treatment is one time a week. We do for 6 weeks. Some people do for 8 weeks. Some people do every other week. It really depends on the individual and what they need. And then we focus on various behavioral approaches to help the individual sleep better. Again, based on what their sleep log is telling us, and of course, what you know their sleep issue is presenting as, or their insomnia is presenting as. But we focus on things like regular wake-up time. We have this term called stimulus control, where we try to associate the bed with sleep and not with being worried and not with being awake. We focus a lot on relaxation techniques. And then your kind of general sleep hygiene recommendations of avoiding caffeine, nicotine, and alcohol. But where it's very helpful to work with a healthcare provider is obviously we need to tailor those recommendations for the individual. And I would say it's even more important for people with MS because they oftentimes have these other symptoms or maybe have, you know, some functional limitations that we need to modify the intervention for. So what we have found in our studies, and we've actually done a few different studies where we've used different delivery of CBTI. So we've done CBTI in person, which is kind of the typical way of delivering CBTI. We've also used a web-based application. We've also done it via telehealth, so by Zoom, you know, because with the pandemic, it was like, gosh, we have to really quickly shift to doing everything virtually. But the general findings for all of those delivery methods, regardless of what method we use, is that not only did the participants who received CBTI have an improvement in their insomnia and have an improvement in their sleep outcomes, they also had an improvement in their MS-related fatigue, depression, anxiety. So we were very excited to have a positive impact on sleep, but then also these other common symptoms as well. And we're actually hoping to get funding to do a larger scale study so that we can compare those different delivery methods in a larger sample of people with MS.
We've been discussing sleep disturbances. So let's look at the other side of the coin. And I think I heard you begin to answer this question a moment ago. Can you share some healthy sleep habits that people can create on their own?
Absolutely. So I tend to focus on kind of four different areas. One is to help entrain your circadian rhythm. And so you do things like having a really regular wake-up time, exposure to light during the day, because there's a direct connection from your retina to the area of the brain that tells you to be awake versus to be asleep. So light is a very potent stimulus to the brain to tell us to be awake, where dark is a very potent stimulus to be asleep. So those are ways that we entrain circadian rhythm. We also, so then the second category is we focus on sleep drive. So making sure your balloon of sleep drive is as high as it can be, as full as it can be. So that way, when you get into bed, you fall asleep quickly and easily. So things like trying to limit naps to some degree, again, that's very individualized with people with MS, and encouraging people to be physically active, cognitively active, to help keep that sleep drive balloon as high as possible. The third category is reducing pre-sleep arousal. So we focus a lot on relaxation techniques. There's no magic relaxation technique that works for all people. So we generally introduce three different ones. And the goal is to find one that helps that individual with their, you know, to relax and with that stress or with that arousal level. So that way, when they do get into bed, they're able to fall asleep quickly and easily. And the three that we use deep breathing, we use progressive muscle relaxation, and we use mindfulness. So those are the three that we tend to focus on. But again, there's lots of different relaxation techniques. The trick is to find one that works for you and then being consistent with that. And then the fourth category is kind of the other category. It's kind of those general sleep hygiene recommendations. So things like avoiding caffeine close to bedtime, avoiding nicotine and alcohol close to bedtime, you know, reducing noise, those sorts of things that can also be contributing to disrupted sleep.
Well, Dr. Katie Siang-Sukon, thank you for all you do to improve the lives of people living with MS. And thanks for talking with me today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it.
That's going to wrap up this episode of Real Talk MS. Real Talk MS is powered by the National MS Society. And you can share this episode of the podcast by letting your friends or family members know that all they have to do is point their web browser at realtalkms.com/259. You'll find that link in today's show notes, so you can easily copy and paste it right into an email or a text. And if you have a minute, I hope you'll visit the Apple App Store or the Google Play Store and download the free Real Talk MS app for your iOS or Android smartphone or tablet. It's the best way for us to stay connected. The app will automatically download the latest episode of Real Talk MS. You'll be able to access any of our past episodes. You'll be able to save your favorite episodes. And it's a great way for me to share bonus content with you. The app is free, so I hope you'll download it today. I'm John Strum. Thanks for listening. Stay safe and make healthy choices.